This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
It's tax season, and at LifeLock, we know you're tired of numbers. But here's a big one you need to hear. Billions. That's the amount of money and refunds the IRS has flagged for possible identity fraud. Now here's another big number. 100 million. That's how many data points LifeLock monitors every second. If your identity is stolen, we'll fix it guaranteed. One last big number. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/podcast for the threats you can't control. Terms apply.
This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Going on, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us here for another podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Angelo.
And we are the Wing and Tail Boys. On today's episode, we are joined by an awesome guest, Dorge of Fire Knock. How are you doing today, Dorge?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Glad to have you. For those of you who don't know, Dorge is the owner and founder of Fire Knock. Started off building knocks, if I'm not mistaken, and then slowly snowballed into some other things, right? So, George, if you can, for a minute, just tell the listeners a little bit about who you are, how you got into hunting, and how Fire Knock came to be.
Okay, I've been a project manager. After my academic studies, I've done a lot of things. I've been a DoD project manager. I'm an accountant. I'm a network engineer. I'm a project manager. I got my 3Com. I got my Novell. I got my DBA. I did not get my bar, so I went to law school. So I got quite a few things. I got my ME, I got my double E. So I got enough hats in my life. And then I did one time, they talked to me about the instant runway project for the US and British John Force Marine, which become the final. Me and Gold Tip, Marvin Carlston started, I make the computer, he made the arrow, the tip, and the British make the gun. The British did not get a gun done. Next thing you know, Gen 3, Gen 5 night vision goggle comes out. Well, it become not important, so I end up inherited it. And 2005, next year 6, I decide... I have enough of the commercial life and decide to retire, and then I start the Fire Knock for something to do.
Okay, and what exactly, for anyone who doesn't know, what exactly do you do at Fire Knock? What do you make? What do you have?
What happened is that I started with Fire Knock. Next thing you know, the more I learned, the more I found new things. Before I know, I got in with 44 separate U.S. utility patents in archery products. So I end up with finer arrow vane tools, you name it, I got it, all the way to crank, bow designs, cam designs. I make a few things. Right now, my SKU for finer is about close to 800. So I do have a very extensive list of, but I don't sell to most dealers. I prefer them to be certified trained. So I start the entire training program for most of the dealer who want to sell my product. So it is a 5 to 7 hour training course, and then there's a 2 hour practical training and a practical test, and then there is a true finish test. If they pass all of the above, they got the dealership and become a certified trained dealer.
Awesome. Awesome. Do you find that you have a lot of people trying to become dealers for you, or people
yes
more interested
no.
in just?
Fine art dealers are a very different group. You can find most of them. I prefer all my dealers not to be carrying any boats. So they're actually string makers, boat tuners, and aero builders.
Okay, so there are more people who do things with the bow than people trying to move as many bows as possible.
Correct. Because I personally think that you should not get a bow for at least five years. That's my average life of a bow. In the case of a crossbow, every eight years.
Okay. Awesome. Now, before we get into the topic of the day, which is, talking about different hunting arrow builds specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Your company started with the making of Fire Knock, which is what you call your lighted knock. And your lighted knock is really cool for multiple reasons. Mainly for me, what got me into Fire Knock in the beginning, and what I think gets a lot of people onto your company or familiar with your brand, are the knocks themselves. Mm-hmm. The issue I had was I was using another company's lighted knock a couple years ago, and I won't mention that company's name. But the battery, after so many shots, the battery would come dislodged out of the knock and actually, shoot to the front of my arrow and get stuck in the front of my arrow, which then made that arrow useless. And what I really like about your product is the end cap that gets glued in there, which is basically a stopper that goes in just in front of the knock and the battery and everything. And if the battery or anything comes disconnected, it stops that battery from hitting the front of the arrow. So what I've always loved about your product is not only are they functional and work better, they also eliminate issues that they have in other things. Other than that, what issue did you see in the lighted knock industry, so to speak, that made you want to make a new knock?
First of all, I'm one of the first guys who actually make a knock that actually worked. The Finax system is original, as I say, is an instant one-way project for the U.S. and British Joint Force Marine. It starts with the ON technology fuzzy logic computer. You got 50,000 transistor. It's a VLSI. I believe that that time is still a 90 nanometer design. So it's a full VLSI fuzzy logic computer. It is not a strict logic. The reason for that, because most people may not understand when you're dealing with an outdoor environment, you cannot rely on any computer. That is normal. Because all computers require a three-volt system. As the temperature varies, the voltage will change based on chemistry. Just like if you put an AirPod on it, the moment your iPhone drops down to 40 degrees, it can no longer be reliable. And when you start hunting, like my customer hunting negative 55 all the way to 180 degrees Fahrenheit. That is a very wide range. No normal computer will work with that temperature range. Being a fuzzy logic computer, it handles all the variation on the computer side because it can handle a voltage of 2.3 volt all the way to 3.3 volt, which means that you can no longer maintain an on-off fuzzy logic. In other words, it's a sine wave fuzzy logic. I'm sorry, I'm a chem engineer and a programmer, so you have to give me some leeway. I can go too deep too fast if I lose you. In other words, a normal computer will not function in this environment.
Sure, we only need one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No, go ahead. I'm sorry. I thought you were.
You just need to simply turn on when you need to turn on and turn off when you need to turn off.
Yeah, I mean, and that makes sense. And for, I mean, I have an iPhone in my pocket. I know you have an iPhone. Angelo, you have an iPhone. Every single one of us has left our phone out on a chair in the sun for too long. And you get it back and it says phone overheated. You need to, you know, it needs to cool down. And I would imagine the same thing would happen if it got too cold. So any of us who have a phone these days understand that, the extreme temperatures can cause an issue with computers. And us hunters are very, like you said, we're very familiar with being in those extreme conditions. Also, correct. Your knock has a very, very interesting way of being turned on and turned off. I absolutely love it. I mean, you just hover it over the ground and just let it drop and bounce and it turns off. It's great.
Well, actually, that was the original requirement. We need a way to shut it off without tools.
Sure.
And need to handle IPX8 compliance, which means that the entire system under its stored environment have to handle 66 feet of salt water for 60 days, about 30 days, and still functional.
Okay.
So you cannot have any exposed environment.
Gotcha. Okay. See, I didn't know that. I just
learned that. Is that the reason why you added the plug in the front? Is it not to stop
the
bat?
No, actually, it's not. The entire FireNut system is nothing more than a flashlight. I'll explain to you why. Everybody of us have used a flashlight in our life, right? And we know that's the only way a flashlight will work is that you've got the lens, you got the light bulb, you got a switch, you got a battery, you got a tube, and you got an end cap. Well, in the final, it's the same thing.
Yeah, but the reason why I asked that is because a flashlight probably wouldn't survive being submerged, though, because it might have water enter it.
As a matter of a military reserve flashlight, would actually handle up to 100 meters.
A military flashlight.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's the reason you notice the FireNut have so many O-rings. Yeah. The FireNut polycarbonate is a different grade.
So my specific question, though, is about the insert Christopher was talking about that holds the battery in place. Was that insert specifically put there so that it would keep the water out from entering into the computer components? Was it designed in exactly what Christopher said to keep it from dislodging?
Well, actually, the first one I have no income. And then what happened in 2005? It is nothing more than a twist lock system, very much like a rehash of the Berkeley snap to hold the battery onto the bed on the circuit board. But that is also in 2006 and 2007. It's also the first year the a spider web target is beginning on the market. It is not the speed of the bow, but the deceleration rate of the arrow that killed it. So I did not even have end cap in it until 2007. Because I was hoping to be able to pull the nut out, put another arrow, just like that. But then the moment spiderweb comes out and the normal 10 point, which is 320 feet per second, and the scorpid crossbow come in 2007 at 420 feet per second. It changes everything. Because with the help of Gary Simons out of Matthew, we discovered a 420 feet per second crossbow shooting into a spider web target, the nine grain battery exceeds 300 pound of force. So my original 176-pound titanium wire breaks.
Yeah, of course.
Makes sense. Now, Ange, to clarify for you, actually, the end cap that gets glued inside the shaft, it actually has a hole in the middle of it. The same way the inserts have a hole in the middle of it too. And that's to allow air pressure to not build up on the inside of the arrow, if I'm not mistaken, right, George?
Actually, that was to comply with the original ATA standard. Before I started everything, I first read all the manuals. Called the AMO standard, which becomes the ATA organization, stated every arrow component, besides the fuel point and the nut, has to have holes in it. And for bow fishing arrow, it had to be solid. That's the reason every single thing we made that goes into an arrow has to have airflow, because to guarantee the insert and everything glued correctly. Gotcha. Of course, a company like Eastern and other companies just simply throw that specifically out the window. They start making insert that's no holes in it.
Okay. Well, then they kind of mixed up the industry a little bit then, I guess.
Well, we always stated that all broadheads should be 832. Well, Eastern come with 440 and others think too. At the same time, you know, I start making brand new generation of inserts that have not been seen in 3 millimeters. So the industry is widening, and a lot of people throw the specification out the window. Just like original string serving size, S3, 0.88, 0.98, 0.122. And we got Martin making Martin and Matthew making string 137.
Wow.
What can I say? It's like right, because lightweight target boost be 188. NFAA, the USA archery is 0.98, and the hunting should be 112. Now everybody is 122, 137, 133, you name it.
Right.
Now actually, you ask yourself, how do you clip the knot correctly?
You can't.
Now you know why, but I make it so specific. Anybody who use fine knot, if your string is not 122 plus and minus 5, plus 5 all the way to 12,000, is not going to shoot right. Because I actually designed it so that it has to be that size, or else it will not shoot right.
Right. And actually, whenever I order like new strings, like custom strings or whatever, when mm-hmm. I order from Gas or whatever, I ask mm-hmm. them, to specifically make them exactly 112.
Yes, correct, because that will make all the difference. So it's like when you go to tires, buy tires, you simply say, "But give me some tires." The first thing they ask you is the width and size of your rim.
Right.
And now you simply say, just give me knocks or give me tires and slip on your car and expect it to work.
Right. So now, real quick, and then we'll move on from the knocks here. If I'm not mistaken, your knocks, the way that they're designed, is mm-hmm. when you push them onto the arrow, they kind of grab on, or when you push the knock onto the string, it grabs onto the string. And then there's a little ball, if I'm not mistaken, at the throat of the knock, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that way when the string is released and it applies the pressure, it actually opens up the knock fingers a little bit to release it from the string?
Yes and no. Actually, that was one of the claimed patterns of my first ever archery pattern is the fine knot. I make a mistake because I didn't know better. I used to let other people do the pattern, but this time I was trying to do it and with a very good friend's law firm. And unfortunately, the gentleman who was working my case have a stroke, which I do not know of.
Oh.
And then my single pattern should be split into five or six separate patterns because that sucker have 54 claims on it. Most patterns do not have five or eight. So my pattern filing cost me over $60,000, everything said and done.
Because every more than two independent claim, every more than five dependent claim,
it costs money. I have 11 independent claims, and then something like 33 dependent claims.
That's wild.
you didn't know better, right?
No. Yeah. All right, so just to kind of summarize,
it does do that function or it does not?
All right, it does that function because that function was not actually emphasized. Because what happened is that, being a pretty decent organic chemist and a mechanical engineer, I understand the necessity of a shear release. That's the reason I put a shear lock system into the knot throat. So that when you put the string in, the string roundness is critical. So now when you push it in, the string actually goes into the knot and grabs full enclosure. But unlike other people's knock, my knock actually come out 1.7 degree on left and right. So the moment when you pass the shear throat, the string no longer touches the knock. Now, a lot of other companies, the string actually slide on the entire throat and the beam on both sides, or sometimes bounce up to 7 times, which I've discovered with a high-speed camera. So you ask yourself, how do you get accuracy out of it? And that's what reason I in specifically make them into an independent claim for one of my patents. So nobody's supposed to do that. And well, there is some margin. The original language was not as perfect as it is. We do have people get close to it.
Okay. All right. So as we move forward in the conversation here, what I want listeners to keep in mind as they're listening to this interview is that we're talking about arrows that are flying somewhere around 270 to 300 plus feet per second. If I'm not mistaken, that is over 150 miles per hour, isn't it?
Oh, way over. Because actually, for most archers, which I mean your regular bow guys, my number one recommendation is don't try to shoot over 290. You should drop down to 270 or aerodynamic kicks in. But my majority of mine, just like when PSC Tech 15 comes out, I did a lot of help. I did make arrow that will go through class 3 safety vest. And you can shoot up to 130 yards at 35 miles per hour wind. You will go through class 3 safety vest both sides. And the normal 30-06 won't do that.
Right.
Not able to do that, I would say.
Right. Okay, so, and you kind of touched on where I'm going with this. The reason why I asked about miles per hour is because motorcycles are known to go very, very, very fast. Okay. Mm-hmm. When you're driving down the highway at 50 miles an hour or 20 miles an hour on a motorcycle, the ride is pretty smooth. Angelo, you're a motorcycle guy, so you correct me if I'm wrong here. But once you get over a certain speed, if your bike isn't perfectly aerodynamic, going perfectly straight, you are going to hit what is called speed wobble. Right. And which sends your bike completely out of control, the smallest little error in any direction at a high speed. Right. So what we're talking about today is designing an arrow that is meant to function perfectly under high speed travel. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So now to get into the topic of the day, we're talking about scientific arrows. For the mm-hmm. listeners who don't know, the scientific arrow is a type of build that Dorge has scientifically created based off of the, as the name says.
We're kind of stepping on the toes of the first question. Why don't we have him explain it?
Okay, that's fine. Go ahead. I'll let you take over.
Yeah, so the first question would be, and I know you alluded to it earlier, so we don't want to go into too much detail because we know a lot mm-hmm. of our listeners are going to be new hunters and average mm-hmm. hunters. Mm-hmm. So as simply as you can, if you can, please explain what the scientific arrow concept is.
Okay, first of all, I want to separate a few things because I want to cut the speed off at about 280 feet per second. Because anything above that, we are going to aerodynamics, we are going to tube dynamics, we are going to different vibration oscillation process of an arrow. It gets too technical, real fast. Because remember, I do build arrow that you can actually, I got the, just like the guy from Delaware, they have shooting out of muzzle loaders or air rifles. So, and not to mention today's crossbows, I mean, 10 point make the 515 feet per second crossbow. We're talking over 340 miles per hour.
That's insane.
So the technical specifications of those are so high. You're going to need at least $2,000 worth of tools before you start building. If you want it that accurate. So I want to cut it off at 280 feet per second. So right on the get-go, I would say concentricity and also aero deflection control is what people are mostly looking at. You just look at this 2 points, you pretty much will get a decent aero.
Okay, and for the listeners who aren't aware, what is can you define those two terms you just said? The first was concentricity, and what was the second?
Oscillation control.
Yes. Can you just explain, if you can, in simply what concentricity is and oscillation control?
Okay, let me give you a simple idea. When you put an insert into the arrow shaft, how do you know the insert is truly concentric with the arrow shaft?
That means perfectly in the middle, in the set, like the center of the insert is in the center
from
of the
front
arrow.
From front to back, of the insert.
I don't know. Well, I know the answer to this, Angelo. How do you make sure that the insert is centered on the arrow?
I'm gonna listen intently here as he explains it.
Okay. Because every component on an arrow shaft is critical. And remember, when an arrow shaft flies, it flexes. An aeroshaft initial flex on the launch base on a 65% of bolt. Out of 70-pound, 300 spine, the back tail of the arrow is going to flex around 6 to 8 inches after you launch the bolt. If you shoot at 85% let off, the tail of your shaft can flex up to 12 inch left and right when you first launch the bolt out. Now ask yourself this question, where's the vane? If the lighted lock shows you that when you launch it, the light will be left and right up to 1 foot when you first launch the bow. Because your arrow is tracked with your front point, if the arrow is not concentric on all the component, when the tail is flexing like that, what is going to happen to the arrow? And by the way, even in perfect flight, say 60 yards down the road, the arrow is going to do 50 to 100,000 flex in flight. Those are all high-speed camera proven. I mean, I saw the oscillation process with DARPA radar system with DNF test. So anybody who have followed me before fully understand this is not a if. This is how it works.
And, sure. And now to contrast that, so we talked about how we can identify that the problem exists if it's not perfectly centered. So how does the arrow perform when you do have the insert perfectly centered?
Well, the oscillation process become a truly elliptical orbital. So in other words, the entire oscillation process is a predictable elliptical formation.
So you take it from being unpredictable to predictable.
Correct. And then, of course, the second is that the amount of parabolic action the arrow have is based on the sign, front of center, vane, and knock. Now, if you have any of those things not right, as distance increase, as let off increase, as shaft diameter decreases, those error increase exponentially.
Okay. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is because, how do I put it? So when a bow has a higher let off, you're holding
Correct.
So let's say, for example, let's use easy numbers. Let's say we have a bow that's at 70 pounds and it has an 85% let off, let's say. You're going to be holding somewhere around 8 pounds. So when your bow goes from 8 pounds to 70 pounds, there's a 62 pound change in energy.
Well, actually, that's not important. It is not a change of energy that's causing the issue. It's that when as your let off increases, your duration of power applied increases. So the assertion to the force of the arrow shaft had to respond to the force, increases, which makes the shaft a lot more harder. It works a lot harder now.
Okay, so
it's
would you
not
recommend...
just the force, it's the duration of force.
That makes sense. I get it now. Okay.
So would you recommend then if for hunters who are able to taking the least amount of let off or holding the highest amount of poundage when it's fully drawn as possible to eliminate some of that?
Yes and
so
no.
Instead of having an 85% let off, what if I said, you know, I think I'm strong enough to be able to hold my bow back at a 50% let off? Is that going to give me some benefit?
Oh, absolutely. The higher the let off, the faster the energy loss. Just like if you go from an 85% off to a 65% off bow with the same identical force at 60 yards, it's going to be 8 to 12 inch difference in impact point with the same identical launch speed.
So would you say then sometimes the technology, and we're going to get to this in one of the questions that I have, sorry if you can hear the barking dog in the background, but some of the newer bows, that's one of their biggest, you know, selling points. They'll say, oh, you know, we have so much let off on our bow, you can hold it back all day waiting for that one moment. And, you know, sometimes we know as hunters, you're not going to always be presented a shot at the perfect time. Sometimes you have to anticipate where the deer is going to be. And if the deer's, you know, walks behind the tree, this is my moment. But then it stops behind the tree. And now two minutes goes by and everyone's got that thought in their mind, like, I don't want to be stuck in that position. I'd rather have a bow with 85% let off. But now you're talking about, right? You're talking about significantly increasing the ability for you to have something go wrong in your flight if your arrows are not built properly. And now you're adding fatigue into that, right? So for the people who are using this bow for these reasons, Yeah, it's fine. You might be able to hold the bow back longer, but regardless, at the end of that 3 minutes, let's say that that happens, and that's obviously very long. That's probably not possible. I'm sure it's possible, but not likely. You're now adding the fact that you're fatigued. You've been holding the bow back for so long, and in addition to that, if your arrow is not tuned to, you know, to the best that it could be, you're adding so many variables into the situation
Absolutely.
Yeah.
To make things even worse, the thinner the arrow you shoot in that condition, the worse it gets.
Yeah.
See, the whole idea is that the high that off allow you to hold the bow a lot longer because you have less force. But also make your launch cycle a lot more trickier because now the entire bow and hand will both move dramatically. Just like an 85% off to 80% off, the difference is not 5%. But 33% in bow holding steadiness.
Right, and you've given a really great analogy for this in some other podcasts I've heard. So I'm going to steal it. And you say, you know, if you take a 50-gallon bucket, a five-gallon paint bucket, and try to carry it in one hand, you're going to be leaning in one direction, and you're going to be very tired in a very short amount of time. But if you put a 5-gallon bucket in each hand and balance yourself, you can walk a lot longer, a lot more comfortable because your body is even on both sides. Same thing with a higher let-off. As you draw your bow back, the more weight you're holding in the back, you're matching that weight in the front of your bow, which allows you to hold steadier.
Yes and no, because you have fatigue issue. But the biggest issue is how the cam actually behave. You notice a higher let-off cam actually will cause your bow to jump.
Yes.
Your bow holding ability will drop. In other words, your accuracy will drop. But at the same time, just like all the testing I have done, if you want to shoot 85-90% off, the only way to overcome it, you shoot an arrow as big as you can possibly get with the same weight.
Okay.
So now,
if you shoot a...
No, I just want to touch on that. So you were saying how if you have a bow with a very high let-off, let's continue with the 85% let-off, you said that you're going to lose energy faster. Am I correct in
not just that. You will not be able to shoot close range.
Okay. And you also just said, if I'm not mistaken, that you also, in that situation, want a heavy arrow.
No, not heavy. Large size.
The diameter. Got
correct. The diameter of the shot.
Does that? I mean, obviously, you can get a large diameter, and then you can make the thing, the arrow, wherever you want. But what I was leading into was, if you have a arrow that's already losing its energy quickly, and then you add weight to the arrow to try to compensate, now you're making it lower, even lower the arrow's efficiency is going to be even lower because it's going
Just the opposite.
But you said it's the large diameter. It's not the weight. That's where the...
Correct. The larger the diameter, the more efficient it will be. Because the thinner the diameter, the faster it loses energy. And not to mention, let me give you some specs. So at least we are talking the same thing, okay? An arrow technically cannot penetrate until the arrow is reasonably straight. Do we understand what the concept is?
Right. The arrow has to be done flexing by the time it impacts the target.
The majority of the dynamic flex before into a elliptical flex. That is a very different condition. That means the arrow cannot be considered penetrable. That means the arrow is not able to penetrate correctly until it finishes the first radical flex in the launch cycle. That's the reason in the old days with the 22-19, you are not supposed to shoot a target under 16 yards. When we move to a 246, you are not supposed to shoot under 18 yards. When we move to a 204, 20 yards is the minimum. And then when we move to 166, you need 23 yards. Uh-huh. That's the reason if you start shooting a high let-off bow with a 166, you put it at 16 yards, you notice the arrow hit the target at an angle. Because the arrow hasn't start finish flexing. And which is also for the last 3 years, you can see a lot of customers or YouTubers, they will start sporting a brand new Hoyt, 70 pound, 29-inch draw with a 166 with a 175 grain broadhead, shoot a Florida whitetail deer, you go in 4-inch and stop and run away.
Yeah.
How can it be possible?
So this is actually kind of leading into one of our other questions here. So one of my other questions is, I was going to say, if it's possible, maybe you can elaborate on some of the numbers. And I'm talking about, like, as far as comparing to. So one, I was going to hope that you can compare some numbers that maybe could show the difference between how much better a scientific arrow concept build is compared to maybe an arrow that somebody would buy at their local shop or their Walmart. Because that's,
first of all,
Yeah, go ahead, explain.
There's so many levels. Because every single component of the arrow have major implication on how to make it better.
So basically, you know, we're hoping to have you back at some point. Christopher and I are going to dive into this a little bit ourselves on a podcast. So we're kind of just giving everybody just an entry level, just something that they can kind of learn a little bit about, maybe get their interest piqued. But so specifically, we're talking about just like you said, we want to talk about an arrow that's, you know, traveling at like 280 feet per second. You're probably going to have a 28 or 29-inch draw length and a 70-pound bow. And you know, let's just say, you know, for instance, we're going to say that most people are probably looking at a new bow that's probably got somewhere around 80-85% let off. If you're just building a regular arrow to meet those specifications, let's say the arrows are you know, just the same weight, same length, and they've got the same you know, nock, and they've got the same broadhead. Just the arrow itself and the arrow build compared from the scientific arrow concept to just a local sports shop or a Walmart arrow. What's the efficiency difference between two arrows that are built, one with just the scientific arrow concept applied and one without?
Okay, I think I know what Chris is asking me, and I'll try to answer that based on your set of questions. What he's asking is one specific design that I have. It's called Arrow Concept. The arrow concept is a carbon tubing going into the front of the arrow at a small section, not exceeding 45%. That actually is one of the patterns I have. What it does is that it changes the oscillation cycle of an arrow. In other words, it changes the magnitude of the parabolic action of the arrow shaft in launch. Most arrow, as I say, if you do a 300 size, which is 0.300, like a GoTip 22, on a 70-pound bow, 300 spine, that arrow will take about 16 to 17 yards to recover. On a 246, it's going to take 18 yards. The moment you put my arrow concept, which is 6-inch in front of a 28-inch arrow, that arrow will take 9 feet to finish oscillating. So technically what you're looking at is a 600% reduction in oscillation cycle. At a 60-yard with the same identical speed, not weight. This arrow, even at 100 grain heavier, it can hit up to 4-inch higher. You did hear me right.
Yeah, so I mean, for us, I mean, it's clear. So this is something that we're excited about. Christopher's been, you know, educating me on a lot of this stuff as well. And, you know, I'm happy to be able to hear it straight from the source. So, you know, I've started going down the heavy arrow path. And a lot of that kind of is close to what you've provided in your product here. And it's something that I'm strongly looking into, because a lot of what you're getting into in the heavy arrow build is trying to get to the arrow without having to, you know, do maybe some of the other stuff that's more difficult to do. Obviously, we've already talked about how, you know, you have people take somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 9 hours worth of training just to be able to install these properly, because if they're not done properly, then, you know, they're not going to work efficiently. And obviously, you know, you want the product to represent itself and show people the effectiveness so that it can spread the word for itself. But
if
the heavy arrow is so, a lot of what that you want to do is you want to try to keep it from flexing. So, you know, you're basically...
Not at all.
Go ahead.
Because Just like just the like arrow I built for a gentleman with a 26-inch draw, putting 45-pound bow, his entire arrow, when he go and shoot the elk at 68 yards, the entire arrow is 337 grain with the broadhead.
Yeah, and how much more is it flexing? So, and again, I'm not saying that, you know, it's not. So the theories that I've been told is that the heavier arrow with the heavier FOC at launch, you're going to have the front of the arrow pulling the back of the arrow, hoping that in that design, it straightens the arrow out faster. With the drag coming from the feathers, it does not.
It actually did exactly the opposite. If you caught, say, anything over 15% FOC, the arrow would increase. You now significantly decrease the, decrease the efficiency of the arrow. You increase the drag of the arrow. You also increase the total duration of time for the arrow to fly straight. Because you are forcing the arrow to do more work.
Yes.
Right. So,
and that's the point that we're, that's the reason why we're bringing light the scientific arrow build, because there's a lot of misinformation out there and there's a lot of people that are pushing some theories, whether it's the heavy arrow build or whether it's the high FOC build. You know, we're trying to educate the people and let them know that some of the things that they've heard might not necessarily be true. A lot of people are, you know, kind of showing off on, you know, maybe some YouTube videos where they'll shoot like, you know, a trash can or they'll shoot something like that and, you know, trying to make people say like, oh, that's cool looking, but is there really any actual evidence behind their claims?
Give me an idea. If you shoot a heavy FOC, super thin arrow, and you shoot at 60 yards, your penetration, your force will be higher because your slug force is higher. But your total arrow efficiency of flight decreases. It's just like when you started a train, when it started, it takes longer. But after it started, you will not stop it.
Right. Yeah. I like that one. That's a good one.
But at the same time, if you are going to get your kids and get the pizza and go home and eat it, do you want to simply take a scooter, take your electric bike there, or you want to take a train or 18-wheeler? It's a wrong tool for the wrong job. Just like if you go to South Africa for, say, want to shoot a Cape Buffalo, and you think you can shoot it with a 400 grain arrow. You're crazy. But do you really need to shoot a 900 grain arrow at a whitetail?
No, and that's my point. So we're looking to get our hunt, you know, a lot of the new hunters, a lot of the, you know, hunters who maybe don't have some of the education out there, we want to try to explain to them, like, some of this stuff is cool to see in a YouTube video, but is it practical in a real life scenario? We're going to be hunting most of the time whitetails, and we're going to be hunting them in close quarter situations. Most people are not taking some of these long distance shots. And even though we've referenced like a 60 yard shot, most people are probably not taking that shot. So we need to take that into consideration. Exactly. So that's why we need to take these things into consideration when we're thinking about how do we want to set up our arrows? How do we want to set up our builds? We need to set them up for the shots that we're comfortable taking, and we need to set them up for the shots that we're most likely going to be taking.
Absolutely. Right. Let me give you an example. I'll quote Jeremy, the top Matthew bow designer. Just like the interview he had with Exodus. Which is Cameron Deere. He would tell you the most efficient arrow out of a current Matthew bolt from the V3X onwards is a 375 grain arrow, based on the 30-inch draw, 70-pound bolt. Anything above and below that, you are deviating from the most efficient point capability of the bolt.
Sure. Because that's what they're building. That's what they're building a bow to, right? Because at the end of the day, everyone—I don't want to say everyone—but most people are buying a bow based on the spec sheet and what the company can say this bow does. So when they're designing that bow, they're designing that bow to function in the IBO test, which is 30-inch arrow at 350 grains or whatever it is, 375 grains, and that's the arrow they're building their bow to. That makes sense. Now, a couple things I just want to clarify before we move on to Angelo's next question. We touched on a lot of things here. The most important here is what we're saying is if a typical arrow build takes anywhere from 16 to 20 yards to recover, which means it is still flexing when it impacts the target. If it doesn't, if it isn't past those distances. Simply by installing a 6-inch carbon tube in the front of your arrow, if you do nothing else, you go from, just to clarify, 18 yards is 54 feet. 54 feet it takes for a normal arrow to recover, and just by installing the 6-inch carbon tube in the front of your arrow, it drops to 9 feet.
9 to 12 feet.
Based so we're talking 3 to 4 6. Right.
It's 600%.
So we're talking about 4 yards compared to 18 yards. So so for those of us who say, well, why do I need to build this arrow? I'm not shooting 70 yards, 80 yards, 90 yards at a deer. For those of you who are shooting at shorter distances, like most of us are, especially in the Northeast. In the Northeast, we have thicker woods. We don't have these long shots. You want your arrow to recover as fast as possible. I mean, most of my deer have been shot at under 30 yards. Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure that, you know, so for those of you who are just like us, arrow concept is going to help your arrow recover faster.
And to be honest with you, when you talk about 18 yards, I mean, for as a bow hunter who's been put in these situations, you know, at a 30-yard shot, you're still looking at a pretty nice-sized target, especially if the deer is broadside. But even at an 18-yard shot and 15-yard shot, your arrow has got a much narrower window to be able to hit the vitals, because your target is now at a steeper angle, right? So as the deer gets closer to you, even if it's still broadside, if you're going to be at a steeper angle, you're going to find a lot harder to be able to enter the vitals. You're going to have the spine to interact with. And if you're too shallow, you may skim the deer or just maybe hit the side of it and actually not enter into the chest cavity. And if you're a little too high on your shot, you could maybe just pass over the spine and go on the opposite shoulder, and you might hit the shoulder, you might hit meat, but then there's nothing on the other side. You know, so you kind of really have a very small window once you get to that steep angle at such a close, and, you know, most of us are in the tree, 20 to 30 feet in the tree. You know, that steep angle, you really want that arrow to recover, because if there's any deviation and there's still some flex in your arrow, that could be the difference between you harvesting an animal and you maybe wounding an animal that could live for a week or a month and die maybe, you know, in from its injury or in the winter.
Right.
Let me give you an exact example. You remember you guys got a package, the Fine Knock 17-point deer? I shot that deer out of Volo Buck State Park. I'm 34 feet up in the air. I shot the deer 8 inch away from the tree. Straight down.
Yeah. And you're talking about a steep angle.
Yes. I'm shooting an arrow with 9% FOC. Because I want the arrow to recover fast, I was shooting a Muzzy Glue in. Okay, I'm also shooting a Matthew Kill 2. 80-pound, 29.5-inch draw. 70-pound, 29.5-inch draw. The arrow goes straight down. We are talking less than 10 yards. It's 34 feet. The arrow go into the heart and stopped. Didn't go any further. It didn't pass through the heart because I still have the picture of the heart. You can see the heart is right here. The arrow, but the turn the heart, put backside. There's nothing on it. It did not touch any ribs.
Wow. So what stopped it? Was it just because the arrow hadn't recovered?
They haven't really recovered. Yeah.
So guys,
and not to mention, you know how I aim. If you shoot any deer that's less than 5 yards from you, you do not use the sight no more. You aim down the arrow. That's the only way to shoot right.
Right. And for those of you listening, the reason why the arrow recovery is so important is because you're talking about, like take a pencil, for example, and just push it through a piece of cardboard, and then try to push it through a piece of cardboard while you're waving it around and wiggling it back and forth. It's going to go in smoother when the pencil is just perfectly straight. And that's why the energy, there is so much energy being lost in the arrow trying to force itself through the target while trying to crack the back end of the arrow at the same time. One more thing on the FOC thing, and then Ange, we'll get into your next question, is think about tying a rock to the front of a pool noodle, okay? If you take it and throw it as hard as you can, the rock is gonna go true. But the backside of that pool noodle is going to be flapping in the air whichever way the wind is hitting it. It's because all the energy is in the front of the arrow and the back is just along for the ride. Which then makes you have to put either bigger or longer or taller veins on the back end to try to correct that, which is then slowing your arrow down even more.
To make things even worse, as you're shooting the highlight off, the arrow has to now resist the force from the bolt, because remember, the heavier the front, the higher the momentum of the arrow front. So as you push it, and also with the highlight off, the entire thing is going to be, the duration of force is going to be longer, so the arrow has to bend more, the magnitude of the arrow is bending more. Right. Which means that if you do not have an arrow concept arrow, the angle of the node, which is defined as the tip of the broadhead to the back of the nock, that angle is going to be more and more dramatic. Which means that if you do not know how to tune the node, you are going to be off node shooting. And if you do not know how to spine an arrow, every single arrow is going to fly different.
Right. And for those of you listening, the node of the arrow is... On a standard arrow build, on a typical arrow build, the node is one specific location on the arrow that does not flex.
When you shoot it, yes, when the arrow is shot
and the arrow flexes in the bow, it's the only spot on the arrow that doesn't move. But when you install the carbon tube on the inside of the arrow, that node goes from a specific location to about an inch and a half space on the arrow, which then allows you. Yep, go ahead.
That was actually a wrong explanation. Okay. Because the concept was wrong. I want to explain that because as you have normal arrow, when you cross it, imagine your cross is like this. I hope you can see the video.
Yep, I can see it.
With the arrow concept, the angle becomes like this.
Gotcha.
When you're off of the center, any of them, you become significantly higher.
So what you're saying is,
as you decrease the flex. You can allow this to be wider. You are allowing it to be wider. It's not become wider.
So it's just reverse. So maybe there was a spot on a regular arrow, and I think Christopher is going off of a lot of the notes that we took. And I think what he meant to say was, the arrows that flex a lot maybe have a space that doesn't flex. That's an inch and a half. But by adding the 6-inch insert, you're expanding the size of the space on the arrow that does not flex. Less of the arrow flexes.
Well, he's saying it flexes less dramatic.
No. The effect and the result of the flex is less dramatic.
Less dramatic. Got
okay.
Because remember, when you are here, you're off by one inch, assuming you're 45 degree flex, which is ridiculous.
Right.
The moment you're passing it, remember it's 0.75, your sine and cosine comes in. But as you decrease the angle, as you increase the distance, the triangle becomes smaller.
Yes, of course. So there's less, a shallower triangle.
So it's less dramatic.
Gotcha.
Okay. Because theoretically, with a higher FOC highlight off, you only have one eighth to one sixteenth of an inch to hold that node. The moment you go arrow concept, you go from that one eighth to one sixteenth all the way to about three quarter to one and a half. Which is significantly dramatic.
Yes, significantly.
Sure. Which allows your arrow to behave more consistently from arrow to arrow.
Now, to make things even worse, from arrow to arrow. Do you know why, throughout the history of time of every single arrow rest, You allow it to move forward and backward, so that way your arrow rest allows your arrow to rest on the node. Correct. So with today's bow, can you do that?
No, you can't.
That means how the hell did you tune the node? Remember, the longer the field point will move the node forward. Just by moving field point to a broadhead, the FOC change caused the node to move.
Right. So, guys, what Dorge is saying is that over the history of bows and rests, you were able to adjust your rest forward and back. Anyone who had a bow, I would say, 10 years ago or earlier than that, you had rests that had movement forward and back, so that way you can put the rest directly underneath the node of the arrow.
Might be able to see it maybe if I take this off. Yep, mean, Angelo's. I know you said you change your bows out every 5 years, but I've had this, I think, for more than a decade.
Yeah, 2000. It's the that's the Matthews Outback.
But you can see here on this model here, you can see that the rest here is actually adjustable forward and backwards.
Correct, because see what happens is when you start shooting your fuel point, you find out your arrow shoot disc really good. And then you can't shoot it right. And that's the reason in the old one, Satellite Titan was making all the fuel points that everybody shoots. We're talking over 25 years ago. They make fuel point broadhead tuning kit. In other words, you want a fuel point that distributes the weight and the length just like your broadhead.
Right. So
you also understand why all the new broadhead that shoots good today are about the same length. The height of the broadhead is about the same as your fuel point because you try to minimize the variation.
I don't have the whole kit here, but I do have a representation kind of what the kit is. So you have field tips here of varying lengths to be able to test.
That's the reason the old days, like I said, the Titan, they make fuel points about the same length as the original, like the Razorback. Which is what, and then of course you find out the few good broadhead back then will be your Rocky Mountain Blitz, which pretty much the same identical lengths at 100 grain fuel point. Sure. You know why they shoot well? Because you don't have to screw around with the tuning of the node.
Yeah. So what George is saying is that now that the rests cannot be adjusted, and because the length by changing the length of your tip, you change the location of the node on your arrow. You can either adjust a rest forward and back to find the node, or you can change the length of your tip to move the node to match it as closely to your rest as you can.
Which is not easy.
No, it's because not easy, on top of and it that, takes you need time.
But think about it. If your node is off a quarter inch, what are you going to do? Cut a quarter inch off your arrow?
Well, then it moves the node again.
Then it moves the node again.
You know how all this new stuff makes tuning so much more difficult.
Because people don't understand the fundamentals of bow tuning and arrow reactions. I know we're getting off topic, but I want to just point out. Most people need to understand with today's high compound bow, that is five motion of an arrow in flight. And most people don't even know two of them.
Right.
That's how difficult it is. And the higher the let off, the thinner the arrow, more dramatic each of them is.
So, and that's really important to understand. And we can dive into the five motions. I think that would be an awesome conversation just to have in itself.
I agree. I think in some way, I think this is simply a start. So get your listener a little bit taste of what it is. Because I'll give you a hint. When I was dealing this similar thing with Exodus, we spent two hours to talk about the knack.
Right.
And nothing more than the knack.
Yeah.
And we spent four episodes talking about inserts.
But you can. I mean, there's some
for each size of the insert.
Yeah, I mean, but then you're basically custom building bows for people, right? And we have to
custom building the arrows is really
what I'm saying. Yeah, of course. I think I said bows, but yeah. But then you're custom building these things, you know. And as much as we want, a lot of these listeners that you know, and one of the things that we try to present to our listeners too is, you know, for the everyday average hunter, you know, there's a lot of things that are going on and a lot of things that people are saying, and we want to start putting a lot of these things to the test, and we want to find out what's real out there. And I feel like that's what people want. You know, a lot of people, they go on and they look in the videos, one guy's telling them one thing, one guy's telling them another thing, and they're trying to get the best of both worlds. But you know, we want to try to be the voice in the middle to say, okay, listen, we've tried the different things, and this is what works in a real world scenario, and this is what we found, and these are the tests that we've run to be able to show that. And that kind of leads into my next and final question was, I know you mentioned earlier about the heart shot that you had on the deer that, you know, made you realize that, you know, the flex was what stopped the penetration. And you talked about a couple other slow motion videos that you were able to do. What would you say would be maybe something that someone at home could recreate, but what would you say might be a real world, you know, application or some sort of field study? Yeah, maybe something that you've seen. Maybe there's something that they could not conduct. Maybe there's something that you've done that's shown.
No, I will help everybody because we are very close hunting season. And we don't have time for any of this. So if you are one of those guys who I just bought a brand new bow, we're talking 2024 bow, not 25. 2025 is coming out very soon.
Yeah.
And you have a hell of a time getting your arrow to fly right. I'll give you a way to out of this deal. Go and get yourself 300 size arrow, like a Gold Tip 22, and shoot with the what do you call it, like a V-knot of ours or some of the Gold Tip 22 size knock, which is the target arrow. And shoot a 100 grain broadhead with it. I don't care you are 30, even you are like 60 pound draw, 26 inch. Get the Gold Tip 22 size arrow, and all your problem will goes away. It's that simple.
And this goes to just, you know, having quality products, right? So one of the things that...
No, it is simply size.
Size. I mean, yes. I think we could argue also that there's quality in
Of course, but I mean, to be fair, you can buy Gold Tip 22 at 3,000 and 5,000. You don't need to get the Gold Tip 22 Pro Hunter. You can get the 22. I mean, that's actually called the Gold Tip 22 Series. 20 Series Pro and 22, which is a 3,000. I would say if you can get that, like my 300 size is 5,000 to 7,000 straightness, but they will shoot great if you understand how the spine works. But that's another episode, because just talking about spine reaction, we can easily spend 2 hours.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And the reason why we're passionate about it, again, is like, you know, we've said it, I've mentioned it multiple times. There's a lot of gimmicks out there, and there's a lot of things that people are just trying to sell. You know, it can be anything from calls that they use in the woods or scents that they use to try to attract deer, and they try to say, you know, use our product, and you know all the ladies are going to chase you down in the parking lot because of such the big bucks that you guys shoot. But you know, these are things that are really going to help you, you know, increase your effectiveness in the woods and increase your ability to you know, harvest what you set out to hunt. But also it's going to make the process of hunting much more efficient for a long duration of time. It's not going to be something that's going to just be one and done. This is something that's going to change how you hunt.
Yeah. And, you know, just to clarify, Andrew, I think the big question that you were asking was what benefit can newer hunters see in this product, and how can they be sure that it is something that can benefit them? The first of which, Dorch, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the gentleman's name was Tony Warden. What was his first? Yeah, so
Anthony Warden out of Canada. I think he's a 13-time IBO champion of Canada, and he had been through three times Las Vegas champion. So he used to be the pro captain for Hoyt in the 1970s.
Yeah, he was. So to make it real simple, professional shooter. Worked for Hoyt, shot in the Canada circuit, shot tournaments in the USA, and he did a third party test basically between your scientific arrow build using your vanes and tested it against a whole plethora of other builds and other vanes and other knocks. He had all of the data from those tests on his website. He retired, he closed the website.
I moved them all to my website, so you do not lose any of those.
Yeah, so if anybody is interested in, if you're visual like me, if you go to Dorge's website, fireknock.com, and you go to the, I think it's the reference tab on the top right corner, you can see all of graphs and all of the data for all of the different arrow tests that were done. And I think the one that kind of blew my mind, that I don't even need to mention the company or whoever made it, but there was a vane and arrow combination that was made that hit, that I believe he shot at 60 yards or 70 yards, and the arrow hit the dirt at 50. It never made it to 70 yards. Okay, so, you know, the big thing that I hear from a lot of people is, hey, you know, I'm just going out and I'm deer hunting. I don't need the Rolls Royce of arrows, or I don't need the Rolls Royce of vanes. But these products help with a lot more than just having the best of the best. These days where everything costs more money and everybody has to work more, having arrows that are built consistent from arrow to arrow to arrow to arrow, that are spine aligned from arrow to arrow to arrow with the nocks facing the exact same way, with all of your components completely centered on your arrow from front to back. This removes the need to nock tune your arrows. This removes the need to spine test your own arrows. It removes the need to insert tune and broadhead tune your arrows. All you have to do is take these arrows out of a box, whether you build them yourself or you have someone build them for you, take them out, put the field points on, shoot them to make sure they're all accurate, and they will all shoot the same from arrow 1 to arrow 12. So for those of you who are looking for value in products like this, the value isn't only in how these arrows behave, but the value is in the amount of time that you save needing to tune your bow, tune your arrows, go out and walk back tune. Now, don't get me wrong. I broadhead tune my arrows, still my bow still. I still shoot field points and broadheads to make sure that they hit in the same place. But all of those other tunings, I mean, Ange, you've not tuned before. You've insert tuned before. I mean, it takes days of spinning arrows and spinning
and days
tips
that I could be spent practicing and making sure that my form is good and making sure that, you know, I'm ready for the season when it comes. Because just like you said, you know, the season is upon us. And there's people that I know that are still scrambling to get their stuff together. And, you know, these are things that they could have had situated and, you know, could have been out of their mind and off their shoulders months, if not weeks ago. And, you know, that we all know that as bow hunters, it's not something you just, you know, put it down in February and pick back up in September. You know, you really have to hone your skills and you have to be ready, because when you have a deer that comes out that you're wanting to harvest, especially if it's a target buck of yours, you know, you may only have one shot. And if you're not ready for that one shot, it could, you know. And why have the flex of an arrow come into play in that situation?
Exactly. You spend thousands of dollars. Let's face it. Every hunter spends thousands of dollars on their gear. They spend hours and hours on scouting, prep, target shooting, studying, you know, doing all these map scouting, whatever, to come down to the moment where all the work you put in has paid off to the encounter with a deer, whether it's a deer of a lifetime or just something to put to your freezer. Why wouldn't you want your equipment to function the best it possibly can at the moment it needs to function the best? That to me is invaluable, you know. So
final thoughts, Torch?
Yes, I would like to go into the same thought as, because you guys get to know me. I'm actually a car guy. It is like the old days that I wanted to fix everything on my car. With today's technology, unfortunately, if you really don't have the right tools, you can't fix today's arrows, especially if you want to shoot over 280 feet per second. It's going to be horrendous. That's the reason, for the last three weeks, I got enough guys coming to me saying, Dodge, I just would like to go hunting because I finally got time, or I'm old enough, or whatever. I would tell them, go ahead and buy a bow desk before 2014 or 15. And shoot gold tip 22 or any 300 size arrow, or if you can't afford it, get 246 300 spine, and you'll be happy. You're able to get deer. Anything you deviate from that, you're asking for a lot of research. Everybody in the archery industry, unfortunately, everybody trying to sell you new stuff every year.
Yeah.
And 99% of stuff won't apply to you.
Right.
Exactly. And that's what we're trying to bring to our clients. We're trying to bring to our customers, our viewers. We want to make sure that we're bringing them the quality products that they know that they're going to be able to invest in. It's going to last for a long time. These are going to be techniques and you know, these are going to be modifications that you can make to your arrows, to your bows, to your hunting styles, to whatever it may be that we talk about. We want to make sure that people understand we're trying to make them the most efficient that they can be, so they don't have to waste the time. A lot of these people, they work all week and they only have a limited amount of time to hunt. We want to make them the most effective and the best hunters that they can be.
Exactly. And you touched on it earlier. You're shooting you're trying to shoot heavier arrows these days. I went from
just to clarify, I actually have, you know, my bow is tuned to two different arrows, and unfortunately, you know, that makes it hard for me. I have to tune them every single year twice. Earlier in the season, I do hunt in thicker bedding areas, so, you know, I've told our viewers before, I tend to use a little bit of a heavier arrow in the early season just to help me out in some of those areas, but then, you know, when I am going to be shooting a little bit longer distance, maybe in the later season in the fall, I go to a little bit of a lighter arrow because I want the stability at distance, like we were talking about. You know, I want to take away the ability to have the arrow flexing and deviate my shot. And if we're talking about having to take a 40, 45 yard shot, if my arrow's been flexing in the wind, there's a chance that I could be off my target and potentially wound a deer or not recover it or miss completely.
Right. And, you know, the cool thing is, like I said, I've shot heavy arrows in the past. I shot heavy arrows with heavy FOC in the past. And these arrows are the best flying arrows that I've shot to date. I'm a firm believer, not just because the research shows it, because I've used all different types and I've seen the results in all different types. And I just love the way these arrows behave. And Angela, it's really cool because now the viewers can follow along with you because you're saying you have two different arrows for two different times a year. So it'd be really cool as, you know, as you start learning more about the arrow concepts and if you choose to use them and test them, I think you'll find that you can make one arrow that does well both in the thicker spots and the
sometimes,
long shots.
Like Dortch said, when we have a passion, sometimes you know, people elevate out of just being an everyday hunter that wants their setup to work as soon as they take it out of their bag. There's something to be said about, you know, like he made the reference of older cars wanting to do it yourself. Sometimes it's fun to me to be able to just tinker with the bow and tune the bow and do stuff like that. So that might not be for everybody, but it's just something that I do to, you know, amuse myself.
Now, Dortch, but before we wrap this up today, we want to invite you to join us in a little hunting challenge this year, if you're interested. Angelo and I, I live in Pennsylvania. He lives in New Jersey. Our family has property in New York State. And this part of the country is called the Tri-State Area. So we decided to start up a little competition called the Tri-State Trifecta, where we're trying to shoot a deer in the three different states that we hunt. So just a little friendly thing, and if you'd like to join in, we'd be happy to add you to the board.
Well, I mean, and I only hunt public land, so you figure that out.
Okay. Yeah. Same here. You know, so for our listeners who are listening, we mentioned earlier last week that Kevin Creely, a friend of ours, shot a deer in North Carolina. Angelo has shot a deer this weekend in New Jersey. Spoiler alert. So Angelo is on the board with his first leg of the trifecta,
and it's a story for the ages.
It is a story like you wouldn't believe. Dortch, if you have some time after we end this recording, he'll tell you the story. But you listeners are going to have to listen in next week to hear it. I promise you, it's something you're not going to want to miss. We want to thank you again for listening to our episode this week. If you like what you hear, please feel free to leave a 5-star review. It really helps us out. And make sure you let us know what you want to hear in the future. And we'd like to tailor some of our episodes to what you want to be hearing. If you guys don't have anything else left to say for today, I want to thank the viewers for listening.
Yeah, thank you, Dortch, again for joining us.
Yeah.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Absolutely.
Do you want to plug your website one more time, how they can find you, how they can find your products?
If you have a thirst to learn, I think I got about close to 20 to 30 credit hours of physics and aerodynamics on my website, and there's enough lectures on YouTube videos. If you're really thirst to learn, I think I'm willing to help you out.
Yeah.
It's and where can they find that?
.com. On the YouTube is FireKnock TV.
FireKnock TV, FireKnock.com. Check them out.
Yep. Also, last thing, anyone who buys a product from Dortch is going to get the pamphlet, like a flyer, his magazine. And in that magazine, he has done a lot of work to try to simplify the wording of all of that education. So if you find on the website,
credit to Andrew University English Department. They were kind enough to send me two of the master, five of the bachelor, non-scientific for this internship. So they wrote it up to, I would say, a 9th grade English plane with minimum science.
Okay.
So
yes.
I really thank them for that.
I'm going to need that pamphlet.
Absolutely. So guys, make sure you read the pamphlet. Again, thank you so much for joining us, Dortch. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And until next week, remember, commitment breeds success. Have a great day.
Have a good one.
Nice to meet you all.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.